For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kit Blanford. In the cave with me, your favorite troglodytes, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle.
Hey, hey.
Gentlemen, did you vote?
I sure did.
I definitely did.
Yeah, I did also. And so, you know, I was watching the news this morning, getting all the results. And it's interesting because, you know, you were seeing some people saying, oh, it's wonderful. It's fantastic. And other people are saying, it's the end of the world. It's over. Nothing's ever going to happen right again.
You know, and what's interesting about this election is it's people in the same party that are having those reactions.
Right.
So, yeah.
You know, we found ourselves now looking at the best of the worst of us, or the worst of the best of us. I'm not sure what we're going to see coming out of this whole situation. We've got one side already stepping out and saying, well, we're not working with them. And the other side saying, well, you know, well, okay, well, if you don't want to work with us, I guess we'll have to do something on our own. And, you know, it's going to be a real interesting tip of one way or the other to see how all this works out. I know personally, I look back and, you know, I'm showing my age here, but I'm looking back to the Reagan years.
Okay, when, yeah.
When honestly,
you were probably a toddler.
Right. When, and also, I will make this observation. I find this fascinating. When the big blue wave meant that the Republicans had won. I remember that great big blue map with the whole map blue and one little red state up there in Minnesota that Mondale had won.
Oh.
And somewhere along the lines, those colors flipped.
Yeah.
And I don't know when or where.
Don't know when or where those colors flipped. But the thing that I remember most about the Reagan era was that the fact that you had two strong leaders. You had Reagan and you had Tip O'Neill. Opposite sides of the political spectrum, but instead of saying, I'm not working with you, I'm not working with you, they reached out to each other, and it did work. So, you know, whether we're going to see that or not, I don't know. Are we finding ourselves, you know, going into a world of dystopia? Now, there's your word for the day. That's our word for today, dystopia. And in just a few minutes, we're going to be joined by Dr. Gwen Adams. We're going to be talking about dystopic literature. Now, for those of you who may not be familiar with that dystopia term, think of utopia. Utopia. Things are wonderful. Things
ideal.
Are perfect. Ideal world. Dystopia, flip that coin. Take a look at the other side. And we're going to take a look at some dystopian literature and those kinds of things, how popular it is, maybe why it's popular. And, you know, just what that says about our world. And we're going to take a look at that right after we get back. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
The disciples of Jesus were beside themselves. The woman following them was being a nuisance. She was an outsider. Hadn't the disciple John written that God loved the world? Did God's love stop when people became annoying? The disciples weren't certain that the Messiah would come for all people. Is it any wonder they thought Jesus should ignore this woman's request? Wasn't it beneath him to listen to her? Yet this mother would do anything for her sick child. If Jesus could heal, perhaps he would have compassion and heal her daughter. She was quick to agree she was an outsider. She was desperate. She just needed help. The way Jesus treated this outsider taught his disciples a powerful lesson. He had come to this world for everyone. The daughter was healed. The woman demonstrated powerful faith, and the disciples saw firsthand that Jesus wasn't a savior who required proof of nationality, income, or address. Yeah, he came for you too. Catholic Radio, Indy.
An interview with Father Trenton Rauch and his story on how Catholic radio influenced his vocation.
I was not struck by lightning and knocked off my horse. I had a lot of time driving in the car listening to the radio, and I just gotten to a point where I would prefer to listen to something that would be intellectually stimulating. And at the same time, I was learning about the faith, particularly the apologetics.
Catholic radio, building faith, building vocations.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a ministry reaching out to Central Indiana and beyond. We have information available about what's happening in parishes here in the Hoosier Heartland, as well as access to the latest from Rome, plus apologetics and authentic Catholic teaching. We are your source for 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave, and joining us once again, our good friend, Dr. Gwen Adams.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Hello. Nice to be back. Yeah.
Well, you are the perfect guest to bring in for our topic that we've been discussing, which is post-apocalyptic dystopian settings, literature. We want to bring in literature at this
Great.
Point.
That's what I wanted to talk about.
It's a bright,
that's why you're such a good fit for the cave, because you're kooky like that. I've noticed your palms have grown furry too from being in the cave. Well done.
Yeah, yeah. If you back up from the mic though, we'll get that echo effect, which is like we are in the cave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, the only problem is that doesn't make good radio. So.
No.
Yeah. Stamp on that mic.
Okay.
So let's unpack just the title a little bit. So post-apocalyptic dystopian literature. What on God's green earth are we talking about?
So I got really interested. Well, I find it interesting. As a kid, I probably started reading 1984
Orwell.
Oh, yeah, and it was very fascinating and
nothing like happy childhood memories.
Yeah.
I also read The Secret Garden and, you know, other stories about being an orphan and really sad. All good stuff, right?
But as I got older,
I started to realize there's a lot of stuff written about how post-apocalyptic literature is really a pretty new phenomenon. Maybe The Time Machine, which is H.G. Wells around the turn of the century, is the first technical futuristic novel. And I thought, oh, wow, so this is a 20th century phenomenon. And isn't that interesting? And then, of course, you know, with The Hunger Games and Maze Runner, the last 30 years, there's been a huge rise in young adult literature.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and I've been fascinated. So why do they like it so much?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. One of the ones that's been popular that I've seen out is the girl who bought a city or ruled a city? But once again, it's... There's a fascination with, I think part of it is, if kids could rule the world, I think is part of it. You know, if there were no adults around, what would the world be like?
Oh,
I think it's part of the thought process.
Okay.
There. So
that's different from where I, okay, go
yeah,
ahead.
Yeah, so I think there's a little bit of the thought experiment of where do we draw our morality? Where do we draw our ethics? Because we're growing out of that age of getting it from our parents and following everything that our parents say. So if we drop these worlds where there really are no parents, there really are no rules, what are the ethics going to be like?
Oh, okay. Now that's definitely appealing to an adolescent.
To a teenager.
Every era. But I was thinking that it's not just the appeal of that adolescents, really anybody has of, I want to be in charge, which is not... all, you know, is not completely bad. Freedom is a gift. But I was also thinking that young adult dystopic literature arose in an age when it's not that they want to get away from these good parents. It's that all these young adult novels are full of parents and adults who have really let them down. I'm thinking like in The Hunger Games, the father died because the government is so oppressive, and then the mother completely collapses. So the adolescent daughter has to take care of everything, of getting food. And the same thing in The Maze Runner, they are the subject of a scientific experiment by adults who are sort of farming them out. And I thought, actually, that's kind of our culture now. What is it? Yeah.
You know, that theme of experimentation, mm-hmm. of being subject to an experiment, because that's the, you know, that's
which
kind
is ghastly and yeah, cruel. Often.
And I should, yeah. I should preface this. And yeah. some of what we're talking about, there are going to be some spoilers that we necessarily disclose, but yeah. You know, the Divergent series too, you know, that's kind of the subtext behind it is, you know, mm-hmm. experimentation on this group of, well, I guess the adults are implicated in it a little bit too, but mm-hmm. it's mostly focusing on the kids and mm-hmm. You know how it affects them. But once again, it's experimentation that kind of renders the adults in the room sort of obsolete.
Does this mm-hmm. would some of the strains of come out of that was the genesis maybe if this genre did emerge say 30 years ago ish? How much of that do you think is tied to, say, the Cold War with the looming? So post-World War II, you've got looming threat of complete nuclear destruction. Is that what begins to maybe plant a seed in our imaginations about, well, what would it be like if all of civilization collapsed? Because prior to nuclear weapons, it's hard to imagine like a planet-wide type catastrophe, with the exception of, say, something that was like a giant meteor slamming into the Earth or something like that. Do you think there's ties back to sorts of fears and apprehensions that we had?
The time machine is prior to any kind of Soviet takeover and certainly before any nuclear war. But science, the capabilities of science are appearing stronger and stronger, and then there's
being
World
unleashed.
War. Yeah,
oh, you're right.
And
you're
then
right.
There's World War One and World War Two. So you
see technology right. being put yeah. to lethal use, right? Like yeah. like mustard gas.
Yeah. Yeah, and governments that have incredible powers to force people to go or do whatever they want.
Yeah, expanding the genre just a little bit. You know, mm-hmm. Frankenstein looms as one of the first ones, and once again, it's very
we
much
just hit an anniversary with that too, right?
Right, 100 years right, or yeah. But it's very much a questioning of technology mm-hmm. and questioning of science and what kind of world science is going to build for us in mm-hmm. the future. So it fits in with the whole dystopia, even though. Yeah, I guess having a monster running around is kind of dystopic.
It's got to be 150 years.
Power going out of control, though. Yeah. And what they all have is a deep anxiety about the future.
Oh, that's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that I find interesting. That's a flip that I think, if you look at it sort of society-wide, I think that flip has happened kind of within our lifetimes. You know, they constantly are polling and asking the question, you know, do you think tomorrow is going to be better than today? Do you think the next generation is going to have it better off than we have it today? And I kind of remember, it seems like it was right about the late 1980s, early 1990s, where that optimism about the future, that the next generation was going to have it better, it kind of started to wane and flip. And now I bet you it'd be pretty overwhelmingly pessimistic if you asked that question.
Oh, yeah.
You know, our future generation is going to be better off than we are now. I've got to think most people would kind of say no.
Right. I'm reading Shep Hugh's Strangers in a Strange Land right now. I don't know if either of you have read that. But he brings up this example, which it just sort of boggled my mind. In the early 80s, when somebody inserted poison into Tylenol, I think it was.
Yeah,
Tylenol.
I remember that.
And the whole nation switched over to childproof caps and seals. And everything has a seal on it now. And it's like within one lifetime, the whole nation can't go back to an age where you could just buy something off the shelf. I return things with the seal broken all the time, you know, because and if you think about it, you think we're all afraid that somebody's just poisoned our medicine or our food or whatever. And you think, gosh, what, I mean, talk about anxiety. It's
right.
Like,
and as rare as that is.
Yeah.
But it's, you're right. It presents itself as if it's imminent. an imminent threat.
Right, even not an isolated. Are, yeah, exactly. Right,
the odds are wildly against it.
You never hand out apples at Halloween anymore because that, you know, those...
The razor blades.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Which probably happened once, if ever.
Yeah.
But, you know, it wasn't a common thing.
One thing, and maybe that's part of technology, is that you know about all these things all the time. So all of us change our behavior to live in ways that are really... They're just full of anxiety. And so then kids grow up and they're reading these books about dystopic worlds. And like, yeah, it's a mess. We're in danger.
Well, that has to do a little bit, too, I think, with how we're raising kids. You know, are we instilling in them, you know, the tools and the toughness to embrace life as an adventure and really put themselves out there? Or are we sort of insulating them and encouraging them to continue to live in our basements until they're, you know, near 40?
Right. Yeah. And when you start to think about it and peel it back, it's a very cynical type of thing to have these dark apocalyptic, you know, views that, well, the world could very easily, the world's a fragile place and it could very easily become broken to the extent that, you know, we're running around having to, you know, worry about whether our kids are going to get elected to become gladiators.
Right.
You know, that's a
yeah.
And that kind of cynicism too, I don't think came out of nothing. It didn't just sort of materialize.
My theory is that it's partly the effect of how much divorce we have. Because I think if your parents cared for you and nurtured you, and especially if they had the faith and really God is going to take care of you, your response to whether there's going to be an atom bomb or an epidemic or science getting out of control would be very different if you were, instead of if you were sort of like an orphan.
Yeah.
Kind of trying to figure out, I don't know, I'm going to have to take care of myself.
Now, the genre itself wasn't really invented as adolescent literature.
No, I mean, you go back
and I'm thinking of most of Michael Crichton's
works.
Jurassic Park and Andromeda Strain and almost all of those, you know, fit into this sort of apocalyptic type of at least maybe how the apocalypse is going to happen or trying to predict it. And you know, the
Planet of the Apes, and that's another one.
Planet of the Apes, the zombie movies, all of the whole zombie genre that's
Walking
out there.
Dead.
So, you know, these are things that are, you know, these are things that are out there in the culture.
Bird Box.
Exactly.
They just don't stop.
Yeah, you can just go on and on and on. And so it's almost as if there was a generation of adults that bought into this, and now it's filtering down to the kids.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's probably true. Yeah.
I wonder if the what do you think, Dr. Adams, what do you think some of the attraction is, say, in that adolescent age group about this apocalyptic literature that they find so appealing?
Oh, well, like you were just saying, I don't know if there's a lot of cynicism there. I don't know if it accurately reflects reality, but I think it reflects how they feel. And I think a lot of young adults today, they are living in broken homes. They are living in violent schools. A lot of them know of suicides in the schools or know of people who were shot, and then the news is full of horrible things. They can't wake
social
up.
Social media might be a
yeah,
role,
social
too,
media.
Right?
They can't wake up without hearing bad news. And I think that's pretty much how it feels all the time in these novels, which are, you know, they're exciting and fast-paced, and the characters are attractive, and they're just trying to figure out, how am I going to stay alive, and how am I going to find something good in the world? Which, that's a really important question to ask.
You know, and yet, when you peel it back and you kind of look at the statistics and you look at the crime reports and all of that, you know, the world is in a lot of ways a safer place than it was
by far,
in the 1970s and 1980s.
And
it doesn't feel that way on the news.
No, because
anxiety is irrational. I mean, you can look at all the statistics and you still say, but something could happen. Well, okay.
Right. You know? But yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, as far as environmental catastrophes, you know, the air is cleaner, the water's cleaner, you know, the pollution has improved. Medically speaking, you know, medical science is now able to handle things that it was completely inequipped to deal with in the late 70s or early 80s. So by every sort of rational measure, things have gotten better and better, and yet the popularity of these sort of apocalyptic scenarios has increased.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the popularity and just the sheer number of them, right? Mm-hmm. It just seemed like legion. There's just show after show after show.
Well, I still go back to these are a type of thought experiment. I mean, mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, the whole science fiction genre. You know, we were talking about Christopher Nolan films a show or so ago, and we got into what science fiction allows you to do. Mm-hmm. And so it allows you to play these sort of thought experiments of what if. Okay. And so I think the whole genre in some ways is playing that, well, what if, and playing on our anxiety as well. What if it turned out that it was true, that we were suddenly going to be inundated with a virus that could wipe out half the planet?
Destabilize institutions or remove institutions completely. When we talk about, maybe this is just the geek in me, but Dr. Adams, when we talk about define dystopian, what do we mean by something being dystopian? Maybe some of our listeners may not be that familiar with that term.
Oh, gosh. It seems to take every kind of form. There's all kinds of coercion and imprisonment. There's the separation of people who love each other and separation of families. There's all kinds of suffering, like disease and poverty. And
sounds very dark.
Yeah. There's usually an element... I'm wondering if this is true for all. Well, not for Frankenstein, if we're going to count that. But a lot of them have an element of a very powerful authority figure who has zero interest in your flourishing and good.
And what's funny as you're talking about that, I'm thinking not necessarily of dystopian literature, but of fairy tales.
Oh, yeah.
That a lot of the fairy tales have the same sort of dark elements in
as the
background.
Fairy tales.
The wicked stepmother, who's not your real mother and has no interest in your good.
Right.
Yeah, there for other reasons.
Somebody pointed out, Disney's remakes of all of these fairy tales, and I think it goes back to the fairy tales, not necessarily anything from Disney, but all the parents are dead.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I hadn't thought about that.
No, actually, reading this Chaput book and listen, like, he lists all these terrible things that have happened in the last century, and there have been a lot of terrible things. Mm. But I was also thinking, what would it feel like to be in the decade after the Black Death, the bubonic plague, when a third of Europe died? I mean, everybody lost their parents.
Right, and they had and I think they really had very little, if any, understanding as to the cause of it either, right?
No, I think there would be...
So this mysterious, horrible, deadly disease.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you look around, one out of every three people are dead.
There's a point. I brought that up because fairy tales are being written down in like the two centuries after. They're not being invented. They're much older than that, but
they're very, I mean, at least the ones that we're accounting and talking about now are very much a reaction to the bubonic plague and kind of
being an orphan is really common experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But yet we, when we're looking at this dystopian literature that's going on now, nothing like that happened. We don't have any sort of huge bubonic plague that happened, two or three generations ago that we're still trying to sort through.
I was thinking that it's not so much the outward physical threats that are the danger, although they seem that way, I think, because of our anxiety, not because of any real data about them. But all of them are asking a deeper question. Say there was a problem, like you said, a thought experiment. Say this happened. Can I trust anybody? That's the thing. And that's like, that goes back to Shakespeare plays or Greek tragedies or, who in the face of a danger, are you going to betray me or are you going to help me? And that's a very frightening question.
That I think you put your finger on something. I've enjoyed The Walking Dead from the beginning, although I will say the last couple of seasons I've kind of trailed off a little bit. I've lost some interest. But I do think in The Walking Dead, that is one of the, if not the primary question, is who can I trust? Now that all the government and all these institutions have been wiped away and we're starting from zero and there's imminent threats, and you begin to realize, yes, the Walking Dead are to be feared, to be sure, but they're not the deadliest. The deadliest are your fellow brothers and sisters.
Right. And I think it's because of that element a little bit that in some ways, this literature works a little bit like apophatic theology. So, you know, apophatic theology.
Yeah,
and spell it, even though it's radio.
Yeah, nice. Yeah.
That's one of those words where I'm not sure we can spell without Google.
Okay, so
we're on Wikipedia right now to see.
So, yeah, now that I brought out the big word, I have to define it. So, apophatic theology.
I'm never playing Scrabble with you for money. For money.
Yeah, okay.
So, apophatic theology is the way of negation. It's the way of trying to get at what God is like or who God is, not by talking about the positive attributes of God. But by talking in negative terms. So, definitely. You know, it's more accurate when you say God is love. In a lot of ways, it's more accurate to say God is not love in any way we've experienced.
Right.
God is above and beyond love. So God is not love. And so if you think of what human love is, and you kind of think around the edges and negate it, then you can get a better idea of what it means when we say God is love. So by going through that, God is not... Mm-hmm. You get a better definition of what it is. And so this dystopic literature, in a lot of ways, we're looking at who we can trust, or who you can't trust, or how trust breaks down in the absence of the institutions.
Yep.
And so in some ways, it's an exploration of the importance of these institutions that through tragedy or catastrophe or, you know, whatever, we've taken away. What would happen if medical science failed?
Mm-hmm.
What would the world be like? That's a way of kind of exploring how important medical science is. What would happen if government broke down and we couldn't trust government anymore?
Right.
That's a way of kind of looking at this is how important just government is. So it's a way of, through negation, exploring how these institutions and concepts actually work and are important.
I wonder too, is that's a great insight there, Mark. I wonder, do you think, Dr. Gwen, is dystopian literature primarily or uniquely part of Western culture?
I don't know.
Because I'm wondering, because it seems like some of what happens in that, you have different variants of social arrangements that point often towards like the strong man or a kind of totalitarian type regime, the powerful, as you mentioned. I'm wondering if you're already living, say, in communist China, do you have an appetite to further explore? Maybe you're already experiencing a kind of dystopian. And maybe it's limited to, or where you have democracies or
that's interesting.
Elements of freedom.
Do you have people call in or comment? Because that I have no idea, but that would be fascinating to see if in a.
Yeah.
The only examples I can think are Western culture.
Yeah, actually. And I'm trying to think through Soviet literature. Literature that came out of the Soviet period.
Yeah,
and all
but
that.
They're
and honestly,
they're kind of Western. I mean, certain.
Well, not only are they kind of Western. In some ways, they're the foundation of Western literature now in a lot of ways. But no, I don't see anything really coming out of that either. And once again,
because maybe you're already living it.
Yeah,
but if they're
all you mean you can't think of Soviet model? Oh,
yeah, I can't think of anything. No, I'm thinking approaches.
Oh, Arthur Kessler, Darkness at Noon. That's a don't you think? Do you know what I'm talking about? I haven't read that in a long time, but that's a kind of a dystopic imprisoned. Yeah.
Well, imprisoned. I don't know if imprisoned and living in you know Dostoevsky's Underground Man might be dystopic, but once again, that's a result of the culture and a result of what's going on. Mm-hmm. It's not a cataclysm.
Not looking to the future.
There's not some sort of apocalypse that's happened or even a dystopia that this is the way the world is, but this is the way it could be.
Okay.
So things could be much worse. I don't know.
What was that term that you used earlier?
Apophatic.
Oh, okay. It made me think of something that I've seen, at least in The Maze Runner and The Hunger Games. Another way of negation is, what does love look like? Well, this is what it doesn't look like. And there's two really important plot threads in both those books where you have people with good intentions, but there's no argument to try to explain how they're actually working for evil, except to show how that plays out. And one of them is willing to fight, use any mean in The Hunger Games. Gale is willing to use any means to fight the enemy. And he's a nice, nice guy. And on the good side, technically, but then I won't do the spoiler alert, but terrible things happen from that. And that's kind of what you're talking about is, it's not enough to be a nice guy on the good side with good intentions, if because some of that behavior is, you know, there's no argument there, but we could talk about the philosophy of ends don't justify the means, and that's not what love really looks like.
Right. And, you know, I, looking at this genre for the adolescents, mm-hmm. as to a certain extent, relationship literature,
mm-hmm.
You know, literature about relationships, what make up relationships, which is pretty much the stuff of most adolescent literature when you break it down.
Or maybe adult literature.
Too. Oh, I guess so. But,
you meant romance.
Exactly. Yeah.
But great literature, too. Yeah.
But once again, how much of a modern invention is that? You know, mm-hmm. trying to go back in time and think through what the equivalent of this would have been prior to... I guess World War One. Mm-hmm. I think World War One's kind of where the modern age sort of begins, just for a marker. So prior to World War One,
mm-hmm.
I can't think of a lot of.
There's
of
some nihilism. Types. I mean, Nietzsche's prior to that, but as a sort of public, widespread, popular, things are really bad idea. That World War One really
even,
blew
or
that
even,
up.
Or yeah. even the you know how. What does love look like? What is love not? You know, that side of what you were talking about, this exploring of what a relationship ought to be, you know, maybe Jane Austen trod in that ground a little bit, but it was still pretty cut and dry what a relationship ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We're running out of time with Dr. Gwen Adams. It's been great having you in the Catholic
Cave.
Thank
you.
Let's spend if you got a couple of seconds.
I do.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about how we can stay in touch with your work and some of the projects that you're involved in.
Oh, well, I still keep that blog at Christian Integration, but I've brought it into a larger website I run called BardStreet.com. B-A-R-D.
Oh, awesome. We got to check that out.
R-E-E-T. And that's just really a name, an umbrella for a lot of different projects I'm working on. I'm like a teacher's retreat in February, and I'm running a theater camp down at a school in Louisville, and I'm finishing this book and writing.
What's the book on?
The book's what I talked about last time. It's the stories of the new evangelization.
Oh, right.
So I'm almost finished with that.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. And the other project, which is really interesting to me right now, is I'm working on a curriculum for the Diocese of Metuchen, New Jersey. They want to dedicate their whole diocese to Our Lady of Guadalupe. And so, isn't that great? Their bishop has started Eucharistic adoration at their chancery, and they're just doing a lot of things like that, which also really good. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. What I was going to ask too, when your book comes out, would you come back?
Oh, I would love to come back. Yeah, so
we can kind of thumb through it and go through some of the stories.
Yeah, listen to some of the stories.
Sure.
That sounds fascinating.
I'd love to.
Well, great. We've been talking with Dr. Gwen Adams. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Great to see you.
And when we come back, we'll kind of wrap things up and maybe take a look at some of the things that this might apply to in the real world. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
Many who live the homosexual lifestyle attempt to justify their behavior by saying their same-sex attraction is natural for them. That's to say, they didn't choose it. But is this justification reasonable? I answer no, and here's why. First, an individual's inclination or desire can't be the standard for morally evaluating human behavior. Such logic leads to the justification of any behavior, even ones we intuitively recognize as immoral. Second, the objection associates the term natural merely with an individual's tendency, as opposed to tendencies that are common to our nature as human beings. That's to say, those tendencies that belong to our species as such and target objective goods that perfect our nature. An individual's same-sex attraction might be independent of his or her choice, but that doesn't make it natural in the sense of giving moral justification to act on it. I'm Carlo Broussard with a Ready Reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a voice for the church that's seldom heard in our chaotic world. were confirmation for the strong of faith and encouragement and answers for those in doubt. We're there to rejoice with your triumphs and to be a voice of consolation through the dark times. We're a voice for vocations and proudly pro-life. We are Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Welcome back once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, and we just...
And an empty chair.
And an empty chair. We just finished talking with Dr. Gwen Adams about adolescent dystopic literature.
That's a mouthful.
And, you know, we were talking, in some ways, we talked more about the adolescent side of it rather than the dystopic side. Because I find the idea of adolescent literature, to a certain extent, is kind of what's new. You know, literature's always been there, but the idea...
The appeal.
The appeal, and not only the appeal, but I think the perspective.
And the setting.
The setting, and so therefore also the questions that are being raised. And one of the big ones we were talking about before we wrapped up a little bit with Dr. Adams was the whole relationship question that a lot of adolescents have. You know, when you look back at relationship literature from the bygone era, you know, Jane Addams, other people, relationships were pretty cut and dry. Your obligations were pretty well established. Who you were who's supposed to marry, a lot of times that was even arranged. If it wasn't arranged, there were a huge amount of social conventions that kind of governed that. And now we've moved into an era where I think there's obviously a lot more anxiety around romance, around, you know, who should you be dating, who should you not be dating, should you be dating, you know, and yes. what marriage is. And I wonder how much of that is fueling a lot of this type of literature.
You know, it's interesting you bring up, too, not just that point, but within that, this made me wonder, and I can't think of any examples, Mark, where in this dystopian literature you really have marriage. The institution of marriage seems to have been kind of swept away. I can't think of anywhere the characters actually aspire to, or again, it's another one of the institutions that seem to have been swept away in whatever apocalypse.
Right.
There might be, if there was a marriage status before the apocalyptic event, then of course that remains. But I guess when it comes to that adolescence, I mean, it doesn't seem like marriage is something that they're necessarily that's being explored explicitly in the literature, but rather it's these affairs of the heart, the questions of like fidelity, faithfulness, love, strong emotions across a wide range, including exploring things like revenge, power. Control. These are all things that seem to be at the forefront, at least from the literature I've been reading.
Well, those are at the forefront of literature just in general. So
often.
Yeah.
Yeah, not unique necessarily to adolescence. Although with the adolescence literature, it seems that we brought this up a little bit earlier. It seems that the adults, if they're present, which is kind of a 50-50 proposition, I think, in some of the literature, are playing a different kind of role, traditional role. Again, that because it's dystopian, it means that there's something gone askew in the storyline and how these social arrangements are being explored, at least through the imaginative literature.
Right. Well, I think the absence of family in a lot of these, or at least the dysfunction of family, Dr. Adams, you know, pointed out that plays a large theme in a lot of these stories. I think that in some ways does reflect back on our society right now, that the idea that family is the foundation of culture, the foundation of civilization, and that kind of everything else comes off of that basis of family as sort of the building block, that's been going by the wayside for a while now. And I think a lot of this literature comes from an anxiety that's been created by sort of the absence or breakdown of the family.
Yeah, and this complete... alienation. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine what it's like to be truly orphaned, where you have no parents and no siblings. And, you know, one example that comes to mind is Carol Wojtyła, you know, St. John Paul the Great. You know, he lost his parents and his siblings, and he was an orphan, but of course he had the Holy Catholic faith. which sustained him in a call to the priesthood. But imagine if you didn't have the faith, and you find yourself so alone, so alienated from others, then these different sort of, again, dystopian, apocalyptic literature, you can relate to what's going on in some of these novels, even if you aren't personally orphaned yourself. But it's just, you can see how raising these sets of questions and coming up with these answers on how one might explore or find oneself or make one's way through the world in these settings can become so compelling. And then they're written in often very dramatic, adventurous ways that kind of capture one's imagination.
Right. And, you know, going back and comparing these to some of the similar literature that was in the past, if you compare some of the adventure stories that are happening now that are around the kids. And so, I mean, I think part of the reason there are no parents there is partly it's a literary device. The kids have to have an adventure. And you're wanting to write a book through the sure. eyes of the kids
or
having this
adventure.
Or why
tell the story.
Right, exactly. So, you know, something has to kind of remove the parents from the picture to begin with to be able to tell the story. But yet in the past, you know, like Swiss Family Robinson, this was a family adventure. It was an adventure right. that involved the entire family, including the kids. And, you know, I think Swiss Family Robinson fits within that adolescent literature a little bit. Although if you've ever tried to read it, it's kind of thick and dense and hard to get into.
I don't think I've actually read the book. I've seen the Disney adaptation.
Right.
Which those are often not all that related at times.
Yeah.
No, they can be pretty different.
Yeah, but, you know, it's an adventure that happens around the context of a family. Whereas now, I think with the adolescent literature now, the parents have been removed to allow the kids to have an adventure in the absence of the parents.
Right. Well, I think, moving a little bit more towards maybe a genre that appeals that, or at least set more for adults. I mentioned before Planet of the Apes. I think that's that reboot of the series has been, it's got a lot of really good reviews. And it's one of kind of the general plot is, of course, human beings are experimenting on apes and gorillas in hopes of finding a cure for a particular kind of like dementia or Alzheimer's, something of that nature. And the cure becomes like hyper effective in that the monkeys then become intelligent or even more as intelligent as human beings, even more so. What happens though over the arc of that story, at least I'm not sure if they're making any more, but at least is that the gorillas and apes and various apes, they become actually more human, more humane than their human adversaries, led by a group of special forces in this battle for the Planet of the Apes, led by Woody Harrelson of all people as this dystopian colonel who, again, has gone too far and exercises a lot of brutal power and control, not only over his own troops, but a subjugation of another, at that point, at least in the story, there's another sentient race.
Right. And then, you know, of course, the central question there is, what does it mean to be human? You know, what makes us human? What makes us different than the animals? What is it to be truly, I think, a civilized human being as opposed to an uncivilized human being? So that central question of what does it really mean to be human is what's kind of being raised by that whole series.
Yeah, and kind of exploring that. It was interesting, too. I had the opportunity, maybe a little, I don't know if I would throw Star Wars necessarily and some of its offshoots into dystopian, apocalyptic literature. I don't think I would. But what came to mind is I recently saw Solo, which is kind of the prequel or the pre-setting to how does Han Solo's character sort of come about, what shapes and forms him as a young adult and into young adulthood. And one of the characters on that captivated me is a robot, a navigation robot that actually winds up being destroyed. But part of what makes that character the robot so interesting is the robot seems to have achieved a kind of sentience, and at every turn, And she's given a woman's voice. At every turn, she's trying to free other robots who are being controlled by their organic overlords, as she calls them. So, again, it's just kind of it's one of these fun little side plots that are going on. But they're exploring this whole relationship between human beings and robots, and that robots are being subjugated. And it's just another way in which these different genres can be used as ways for us to explore our relationship to other sentient beings.
Well, we're coming up on a break, but when we come back from the break, I want to look a little bit more, particularly you raised Star Wars, and I think you can see Star Wars as sort of a dystopian universe. So when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about Star Wars, about dystopian literature, and just about adolescence in general.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a website, CatholicRadioIndy.org, with access to great Catholic resources, including podcasts of all our local programming, podcasts that have been downloaded from all 50 states and over 40 countries on 6 continents. Yes, we are Catholic Radio Indy, but thanks to your support, we're taking the gospel of Christ to the ends of the earth. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Ever since we've been on the air at Catholic Radio, we've always wanted to have billboards, but they just don't fit in our budget. And since you'll probably never see a real billboard for us, I'm going to ask you to do something, to imagine one. In your mind, picture a large, empty billboard. Yeah, that's it. Now pick a background color, any color at all. Okay, then across the top of your billboard, put just 2 words, Catholic Radio. Make them really big. Then, below that in even bigger letters, put 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Wow, that's a great billboard. Now, if this billboard were real, all of your friends and neighbors could see it, and they'd know all about Catholic Radio. But since it's only an imaginary billboard, we're going to have to depend on you to tell your friends about Catholic Radio. Remember, Catholic Radio 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Oh, and by the way, nice choice on that background color. It really looks good.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell. In the cave is Mark Tuttle and our producer, Kent Blanford. Right before the break, we brought up Star Wars and started talking about that. Now, Mark, you're going to place that in the category of a dystopian, apocalyptic literature.
Certainly, yeah. I think especially where they've taken that series lately with the side stories, story of Rogue One, Solo.
Love those.
As they're creating these stories, they're putting them within the universe of the Imperial takeover and what the world is like. And you can see it. It's getting darker. You're starting to see the street urchins come out a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And you're starting to see this sort of seedy underworld that the characters are inhabiting. And it is a dystopic type of universe that they're creating for these characters to then have their adventures in.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the, again, kind of spoiler alert, one of the things from Solo, Kira is his love interest. And he doesn't realize that he realizes that she's has an allegiance. They'd been separated for 3 years. They're reunited. She's given her allegiance over to the Crimson Dawn or Crimson Tide. I want to say Crimson Tide, but that sounds like that's a band.
Yeah, I was going to say, but if you're giving your allegiance over to the Crimson Tide, I think you're kind of in that same category.
Correct. Correct. And behind that actually is a Sith,
right?
At the end. But he doesn't realize, but she says, he's like, well, I'm an outlaw now and I'm doing all these things. And she says, well, I know the real you. And he says, okay, well, what is the real me? And she says, that you're the good guy. And then it's not too much. And he's like, no, I'm not the good guy. And so she has this kind of insight into his character. And we all know from the Han Solo character, even going back to the very first Star Wars movie, is that he's a reluctant hero, right? He plays the bravado, swashbuckler, Han Solo character, outlaw, renegade, smuggler. But when push comes to shove, at the most important, decisive, moral moments, he does throw his allegiance in with the good guys and shows that he is a good guy.
Right. And, you know, I think all of
it. And that's fun.
Yeah, and that's fun. And, you know, Star Wars, you know, we said Star Wars is moving more towards the dystopic. Star Wars has always been in the realm of adolescent literature. I mean, it's in a lot of
that's
ways.
That's when I got exposed to it.
It's yeah. when we all got hooked on it. It's what it's the audience that the series continues
Luke
to be made
Skywalker.
For. You know, yeah. I think they're throwing more nods towards us adults that grew up, you know, watching Star mm-hmm. Wars a little bit. But still at heart, it's kind of part of that genre of adolescent literature a little bit. And part of that is exploring the idea of what makes a hero. What does it mean to be a heroic person? When is it that we need to step up and be virtuous? And those types of stories have been around for a long time. The whole idea of the knight in shining armor and what does it mean to be chivalrous? What does it mean to be a gentleman? And right. I'm glad to see Star Wars still continuing to play along with some of those themes.
I agree. One of the things that I like about Star Wars, still cherish, is that the heroes are not these deeply flawed, conflicted that you get with a lot of the superhero genre these days. You know, Superman is deeply psychologically conflicted at times.
And yeah.
So is Batman, and so is Iron Man, and on and on and on. While that's fun and interesting in that genre, I guess I am a bit of a purist when it comes to my heroes. I'm a John Wayne kind of generation guy. John Wayne, you always knew, you know, which side he was gonna stand on, even though his characters weren't perfect, but you knew that he was the good guy.
Well, let me ask you this. You said that you've got a affinity for the series The Walking Dead.
Yes.
And in The Walking Dead, are there the clear-cut good guys and bad guys, or is it a little more of a muddled universe than that?
It's much more of a, I would say it's much more of a muddled universe. What attracted me to The Walking Dead, the first, handful of seasons, I would say, three seasons through season five, is they did a marvelous job of exploring. There's been an apocalyptic event. You don't know what caused it, but you know that most of humanity is either completely dead or has come back are these very dangerous zombie type characters. And so all of these institutions have been swept away. And I just thought they did a phenomenal job of exploring what survival would be like under those circumstances, and some really good acting and good, really good writing. But then they fell into a trap like many do, which is I think they've, after about five seasons, you tend to exhaust your plot line. And now they've been in this, and so I've been slow walking myself these last. season 9 now.
You've become one of the Walking Dead as you're watching the series.
Yeah, I'm glazing over. I'm hoping.
We've gone from The Walking Dead to The Watching Dead.
Right.
Correct.
And you're sitting there going, I can really use some brains.
And they have a prequel. Right. And they have a prequel called Fear the Walking Dead, which is kind of like supposed to be exploring how the whole apocalyptic event kind of came about. And then they're trying to that's on season 3 or 4, and that's they're trying to connect those two different on and on and on. And but I do think that it does signal, though, that there is an opportunity, maybe even if this has been that particular series has been a bit overdone, or it's exhausted, at least for now, the storylines, in my estimation, that it is a really effective way, this dystopian apocalyptic literature, to really explore, as you were pointing out, I thought very insightfully earlier, Mark, that when you remove something, it gives you an opportunity to really, its absence really gives you an opportunity to explore what it actually was contributing. For good or for bad, or a mixture of the both.
Yeah, well, I had a reason for asking that question about The Walking Dead, and that was to kind of see if, it seems like the apocalyptic literature that revolve around these dystopic things, they still have the heroes intact, and they still have the villains intact. Unlike what we were talking about Christopher Nolan and what's going on with some of the superhero genre, that we're moving away from the heroic characters, and we're trying to show that, well, they're just people like us. They're flawed, or even worse, there are no heroes. That everybody is kind of a villain at heart.
Yeah, I think.
And it seems like the apocalyptic type of literature has resisted that in some ways.
It has. And I would say maybe just to wrap things up, because I know we're running out of time here on this episode of the Catholic Cave, it seems moral absolutes might be what is up for grabs in these heroes, that less and less of these heroes have moral absolutes. They have moral leanings. They have moral intuitions. They have a code, but they don't have an uncompromising code in the way we as Catholics would maybe frame things as, say, intrinsically evil and therefore never permissible. That's where maybe that might be one of the defining differences as this genre continues to evolve.
And that is all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for today. We'd like to thank Dr. Gwen Adams, who joined us earlier in the episode. And until next time, for Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, for Mr. Mark Tuttle, I'm Kent Blanford. May God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.